Wow. Good morning, everyone. As you might have guessed, I'm John Morehouse, and it's great to be here. Thank you to the choir and to Ed, my colleague Ed, for that beautiful piece. We're going to have a lot more great music as the morning unfolds. But I want to call us into worship this morning with these words from my friend and colleague Erica Hewitt. As we enter into worship, let us put away the pressures of the world, pressures that ask us to perform, to take up tasks, and to put on brave fronts, to silence the voices that ask us to be perfect. This is a community of compassion and caring. We do not have to do anything to earn the love contained within these walls. You do not have to be braver, smarter, stronger, better than you are in this very moment to share in this love. You only need to bring the gift of your body, no matter how able, your seeking mind, no matter how busy, your animal heart, no matter how broken. Bring all that you are and all that you love to this hour together. Let us worship together. And I'd like to ask Alex to come up and light the chalice.
Please join me in reading the chalice lighting words in the order of service. The chalice flame to remind ourselves of the light of truth, the warmth of community, and the fire of commitment.
Please join me in saying the affirmation, which is found on the front cover of your order of service. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. Thank you. Please be seated.
So Mary and I have a story. She's getting better at this. If the kids want to come forward, any kids out there, any adults that act like kids, you're welcome to come forward too. It's got props, so it's kind of cool to be up front. Here they come. Can anyone guess what Mary is? She's the ocean. Good. Smart people. This is good. Here they come. So, hi, kids. I'm Reverend John, and I'll get to know all your names as time goes by. Some of you are wearing name tags. That's a good thing. That's a hint for the rest of you. I'm clueless without name tags. You know who I am, but I don't know who you are. And I live, right now, I live by the ocean on the other coast. I live by the Pacific Ocean in California. And not far from my house, I can see whales. Certain times of the year, they migrate from Alaska down to the Baja of California, where they give birth to their babies, and then they come back up to Alaska for the summer. And that's go back and forth. And you can see these blue and gray whales all the time, sometimes humpback whales. And this is a story about a whale. This is a story about a whale. It's a true story. And it's a story that begins with a guy by the name of Mick. And Mick has a boat. He has a boat. It's in California. He's in San Francisco. And he likes to take his boat out, and he gives people rides. If they want to go fishing, they go fishing. And he didn't have any work. It was in March, and he gets a phone call at home, and the phone call is from one of his friends who's a fisherman out about 18 miles out in the middle of the ocean outside of San Francisco. And the phone call was, hey, listen, there's this whale out here that looks like it's all trapped in like ropes from crab traps. And I'm just by myself in the boat, so I can't get out there and help the whale, but if anybody would like to come out and see if they can help the whale, it looks like she's really having trouble. And so he calls up his two friends, Tim and Jim, and they are divers. And they say, sure, we'll come over. So they hop in the boat, and they go out. It takes like 2 hours to go 18 miles out into the ocean. And there on the horizon, they see a whale. It's a humpback whale. It's a female. And she's just sort of breathing. She's really labored. She can barely hold on. And she is, they don't know it yet, but she's completely tied up with all these ropes from these traps. And so the divers get into a little inflatable boat, and they go out about 200 feet from the whale, and then they jump in with their gear into the water, and they're swimming towards the whale, and they can see that there's ropes tied all around her head, and they look down in the water, and they can see her tail is all trapped in ropes, and she's like cut into a C like that, and she's really struggling, and she's having a really hard time just staying afloat. And they're like looking at each other wondering what to do, so they jump into the water, and they swim closer and closer to her, but she's scared, and she's looking at them with one eye, and she takes her pectoral fin, which is this big fin here, and she slams it against the water, and it's 15 feet. Now, the whale's as big as this room, so it's a 15-foot tail, a fin that just goes slapping against the water, and the divers get pushed way back, and they're like, okay, this isn't going to work. We're not going to be able to come at her like that. And so they dive down. They got their gear on. They dive down under her, and they come up behind her. And one guy, Jim, he's up near her head, and he's got a knife out, and he's trying to cut these ropes so that she can get free because it's over her eye and around her mouth. And he's having luck. This is starting to come loose. But Tim, who's down below her, sees her tail is wrapped up in a lot, 2,000 pounds of crab gear. And it seems to all be knotted together. You know when you have a really bad knot, how hard it is to get out? Well, that's what's happening with this poor whale. And so what he does is he goes down and he takes his knife, and he says the only way he can do it, he knows he's going to have to cut her a little bit because he's got to get underneath that one rope that's holding it all together. And he cuts away, and magically that one rope lets go, and the whole thing goes bing, 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 bing. And all that trap gear falls to the bottom of the ocean, and she's free. And she jumps and dives down into the water. And Tim and Jim are like, coming up for air, and they're like, yeah, high five, we saved the whale, that rocks, you know, and they're like, ah, great, and they're swimming back, and Jim's a better swimmer than Tim, so he's a little bit farther forward, and Tim's back, and Tim's swimming away here, swimming, he looks down, and there's this huge black face coming up towards him, and he's like freaking out, it's going to be really bad, and he's like, I'm going to get hit, she's going to kill me, and she goes to the other side, and she comes up, and she bumps him. And then she turns and she looks at him and her eyes are following him for like a minute, just back and forth. And then she dives again and Jim's up here. He's the better swimmer and he's swimming and here she's coming up. She does the same thing. He thinks he's going to get hit. She comes up alongside of him. Boom. Taps him and then comes up and looks at him for a minute and follows him back and forth with her eye like she's saying thank you. And she dives, and they never see her again. And that's a story about facing grace, which is I'm going to talk about with the big kids here in a little bit. But right now we're going to sing you out with number 413.
I invite you to join with me in a spirit of prayer and meditation. Close your eyes if you feel comfortable doing so and place your feet firmly on the floor. Connect yourself with the earth. Sit back in your chair and let us breathe deeply together. And breathe out. Breathe in again. We breathe out. This breath that we share with all that breathes on the planet. To feel the love of the universe that is flowing through this community into you and out into the universe again. Let that love, our love, flow outward to its height, its depth, its broadest extent. We ask the Spirit of grace be in us and among us at this time to heal the wounds, to help us with the losses. Let our hearts celebrate with joy for the small successes. May the Spirit of grace be in us and among us now as we gather in this holiness that is the community of this church. Let us be in silence with that grace. May our blessings endure and our struggles lessen. Amen.
Thank you to the choir, to Joanne, to Ed, and to Anita, the worship associate today. I couldn't do any of this without her or with them. It's great to be here. I understand this pulpit hasn't been used in a little while. It's cool. I like it. I tell a lot of stories when I preach. In fact, my sermons are often just a collection of stories strung together with a few, I hope, sometimes profound thoughts. And so I'm going to begin with a story that is a true story, and it happened to me many years ago. There wasn't much to say. It had been 6 months since his daughter had died. He stared up at the night sky, and he asked me, "Do you think there's a God out there?" I started to formulate an answer, thinking about all the different manifestations of God that I'd learned in seminary. But all of them seemed too trite to say to a man who had just lost his teenage daughter. So I said nothing. I think there isn't a God out there, he said. I think God is a drug. And there was anger welling up in his voice and tears streaming down his face. And I put my hand on his shoulder. It was a cool spring night, not too unlike what we are starting to feel now as the earth turns once more towards a distant sun. That was a very long time ago. And for me, as for him, my faith in a greater power was shattered then. I would realize later that my faith was expanded, but at that time, I thought I had lost a belief in God. Now I believe in something else. I believe that we're part of a process of co-creation and holiness all around us, and the universe is conspiring with us to make the world a better place if we'll only listen. I've often thought that we are the hands of holiness, that we're the ones who actually make holiness happen, along with Mother Nature, who does a pretty fine job. Holiness and loveliness are what the world needs most, compassion and love. And I call all of that grace. Not grace in the traditional Christian sense of an unearned gift from God, although perhaps it's that too, I wouldn't be able to tell you. But grace in a sense of something that is unexpected, that comes into our lives, of a sort of synchronicity when we think it's just serendipity. I believe that all of us have a spiritual center. Now, you might not want to call it that, but I do. And I believe this is a spiritual center, as I said in my little video introducing myself. I think it's a spiritual center with a civic circumference, using John Byrne's great line. I think that's what this church is, and I think that's who you are. So what I want to say today is about spirituality. It's nothing that will be completely foreign. I'm a fifth-generation Unitarian, so I'm as skeptical as most of you. So you can just relax. It's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. But what I want to call your attention to, and you want to pay attention here because I just might end up as your senior minister, what I want you to pay attention to is that we're afforded these spiritual awakenings all the time, if only we open our eyes to them. I think that this grace that comes into our lives so often unbidden becomes what I often call the angels of our better nature. All of us have a better nature. Sometimes we use it, sometimes we don't. But it's there, if we face it. It happens crossing a street. It happens giving help. It happens in music, at a checkout line. After the first service, somebody was telling me about how they were in Central Park and they saw somebody helping a homeless guy who was picking coins out of the fountain by giving him a little something extra. It happens in the death of loved ones. In fact, I believe it's no accident that I'm standing before you today, preaching to you for what I hope will be one of a many long series of sermons. I'll be honest to you, coming to Connecticut was not in my playbook. Francis and I love California. We love our church. We love the life we had made there. So when I heard about your church from my good friend Lee Barker, who's president of Meadville Lombard Theological School, who tried to get me to move to Chicago 2 years ago, I said, "You know where I live, Lee, don't you?" He said, "Nah, you know, this is different." So coming back east, well, coming back east to seasons. That may take a little getting used to. But I looked at your congregational record after I got a phone call from one of the members of the search committee to ask me whether I would be interested. And I did. I clicked yes. It's a very scary thing, clicking yes. And looked at the congregational record and showed it to Francis. And you know, we sort of let that be for a while. And we walked the dogs along the beach. And you know, I'd say, "Well, what about Westport?" And Grace tugged a little harder then. And we began this incredible dance that search committees and ministers do. There's a book, actually, about the search process. It's called Like Dating, Only Worse. This is true. This is true. It's like dating and you get married after 1 week. But Grace kept tugging away there, and before I knew it, thousands of hours and thousands of miles later, well, here I am, standing in front of you, open to your love and mercy. I think all of this is a sign of grace. All of this is a gift that's been given to me and perhaps to all of you that I hadn't noticed before, hadn't thought of before. Most of my friends, all of my congregation in California, thought I was crazy. Some of you have communicated with me this past week and said I was crazy. But I'm here. How do we respond to grace? How do we know when there's grace? Grace is all through our language. Philip Yancey, who's a skeptical Christian writer, puts it this way. He said, "We're grateful for someone's kindness. We're congratulated when we're successful. We're gracious with hosting friends. We're gratified by good news. We leave a gratuity for service." And yet, despite all that, when you take it apart, it's like dissecting a frog. It's just parts. What makes grace beautiful is that it does something to us. So I like to tell a few stories about heaven, because I'm a universalist at heart, and I think all dogs go to heaven, and most people too. And there's a story about a man who comes up to the great pearly gates, and there's Peter, of course, and Peter says to this guy, "Listen, this is how it works. You need 100 points to get inside. So I'm going to keep track. You're going to tell me what you did in life, and I'm going to keep score." Okay? He was feeling pretty certain of himself. He said, "Okay, I was married to the same woman for 50 years, and I never cheated on her, not even in my heart. Thank you, Jimmy Carter." "Oh, that's wonderful," says St. Peter. "That's worth 3 points. "3 points? Okay, all right. I attended church all my life, and I served and I gave tithe," which is 10% for you Unitarian Universalists. And he said, "That's fantastic. That's worth 1 point. He goes, "Oh, man. All right." He goes, "How about this? I started a soup kitchen in my city that I lived in, and I served homeless veterans for 30 years. St. Peter says, "That is amazing. That's worth 6 points. 6 points.
At this rate, I'll never get into heaven but by the grace of God. And he said, come on in. So grace finds us, even us skeptical people. Like the divers to the whale, or the whale to the divers, grace is a way of finding us. And I found that it shows up at the most unexpected times. There's a story told of an Italian resistance fighter during World War II, grizzled, hard-bitten. He'd killed all these fascists through the years, you know, and assassinations and bombings. And the secret police were on to him. And so he fled to a monastery in northern Italy. And the monks took him in, and they shaved his head, and they put on a Cossack. And the peasants heard about this new monk that was up there that had seen the world. And they came, unbidden. Long lines of them wanting to give confession to this monk. And he's like, whoa, this isn't what I do. And they're like, well, you do now. And so in the confession booth, he heard the stories about the people that he was trying to save through violence. And he heard about their struggles. And he became a changed man. The first form of grace is in change that is unbidden. Look back over your life. Think about those unexpected turns, because I think those are the most interesting. When one of those moments that you thought surely was the end of your life, at least as you knew it, maybe it was, and somehow you were transformed. That's grace. As the search committee knows, I preach from my life most often. And later this year, I'm going to share with you, if I have the grace of your vote, I will share with you a story that took place around Christmas many, many years ago, but a little bit about it. Alone I was at that time and divorced from my first wife and my failing business, and I was walking along Fifth Avenue, Christmas time. You know how beautiful that is. And I saw across the street a wealthy man drape his very expensive camel hair coat over a homeless person and press a wad of cash into his hand. Something shook inside of me. I got out of my privileged misery at having lost a marriage and a business and reminded myself of the generosity that, as Tennyson said, stirs our souls to greater rectitude. The real moment of grace, though, really came years later in this process of transformation for me when Francis, my beloved, asked me in a moment of marital discernment. You've all had moments of marital discernment? What I wanted to do with my life. Well, I thought at one time I wanted to make a lot of money. That sounded like a pretty good deal to me. I could have married my third cousin and worked on Wall Street or something like that. But out of my mouth comes the words, I want to be a minister. You know, and to this day, I really can't figure out how that happened, how those words just sort of came out of my mouth. And we both had a good laugh about that. Francis said, well, I've always wanted to be a minister's wife. When you get to meet her, you'll understand what that means. It's kind of funny, actually. We're not the usual couple. And I think that was really a lot about grace at that time, that something was pulling me to a very different direction. I'd always been interested in religion and philosophy, but I didn't know I wanted to make a career out of it. The German poet Goethe said that at the moment of commitment, the entire universe conspires to assist you. I think that's a beautiful line. Grace comes to us most often actually through our pains and struggles, not through our happiness. Some years ago, I was called to conduct a funeral for a teenager who had committed suicide. I don't need to tell you here what an unimaginable pain that must have been. Where do you go after the death of a child? Where do any of us go when someone close to us dies? When life deals us a blow that seems to be almost beyond words. More than 200 people filled the church. They were not members. Friends of the family, but more importantly, friends of the boy. Boys and girls themselves who were suffering from the pangs of adolescence. I had told the family that the only way I knew how to deal with this was to be open about what had happened, and I still think that's true, to be honest about the agony of his life and then allow for healing to occur. His mother agreed to that general approach to the service, but his father was not willing. He was angry, he was hurt, he was afraid, he threatened to not come. And as the mourners filled in, I was looking for the father. I wanted to know, was the father going to show up? I knew that he and his son had had deep struggles. I knew the father blamed himself in part for his son's suicide. We waited. The congregation was getting restless. Finally, his mother said, we need to start. So we started the service, and the service lasted well over 2 hours. It's not so important what was said as the fact that we were all there trying to heal from this unimaginable pain. And the mourners would come up, as we often do in UU services, and they would, you know, share what they knew about this life. And, you know, I was noticing that it was not just the parents, but kids would come up, and they would share their own pain, and it became very cathartic at that moment. And it was about halfway through this service that I noticed the father had slipped in the back door. His best friend got up and was speaking about his smile and his laugh and all those attributes that made his life such a gift, telling funny stories that we managed to laugh about in the midst of this tragedy. He stood there for a few minutes, his best friend, with tears streaming down his face, and spoke about his friend's love for him and for his family, and spoke about his own struggle with his own father and how much this boy who had died loved and admired his father. And as the friend sat down, I noticed the father was making his way to the front, slowly, painfully. He climbed into the steps of the chancel and stood behind the pulpit. I stood beside him. The silence was profound. He spoke in almost a whisper about how sorry he was for having pushed his son so far from him. He apologized to his family, to his wife, for his part in this tragic struggle. He hadn't realized the man his son was becoming. He was blind, but he could now see. And then he started to sob. And I held him there in front of 200 people as grief opened her mighty iron gates. And all his own pain from his father's struggle and his father before him and his father's father, generations of pain just came flooding out. And after he sat down, I spoke about grace, and I said the boy had not died in vain because we were being invited to be in love with the world again. And I say that in every memorial service I do, that a death is a reminder to live life. Grace often happens through our pain, not always and not so publicly, but it does happen. And we are forced almost to face grace if we'll only open our eyes and welcome it into our lives and be changed by it. And maybe it's God, maybe it's the universe, maybe it's just the energy of being human. When people ask me what Unitarian Universalists believe about God or whether we believe in God, my rejoinder is usually, which one? For you see, we've been creating an image of God for as long as we've been around. But I don't think that's really important. And you'll hear me say this a lot. I really don't worry about what your theology is or what my theology is. I really want to know, what do you want to do about creating meaning in your life? How do you want to help other people? How do you want to change your world? That's why we're here. I went from believing in God to no God to sort of God back to no God. I went from Christianity through Buddhism back to Unitarian Universalism, and now I'm in this presence of the divine that I can't really explain, except that I keep trying. So I'm sort of an enchanted agnostic, which is, I think, what most of us are, if we're honest about it. The bumper sticker reads, I don't know and you don't either. More about that later. The best I can say, though, is I have a spiritual center that is based in relationships among people. I think that's where grace lives most, in the love that we share with one another. You know, sometimes we make mistakes about what we think is reality, what we think is grace in our lives. St. Peter is once again standing at the pearly gates, and Jesus happened to walk by. Well, of course he did. And, you know, Peter had to use the restroom, which answers one of those age-old questions that people have been wondering about what happens in heaven, but that's true. He said, Jesus, I really need a break here, and can you stand by the pearly gates? And, you know, you ask questions and you let them in if the answers are good. And Jesus is like, sure, I can do that. So he's standing there, he's asking people. He lets everybody in because he's Jesus, you know. It's a universalist story, so. He gets in. And this old guy comes up to the gate. And Jesus looks at him and he says, well, tell me what you did in life. He said, well, I was a carpenter. Oh. Jesus, remembering his own earthly existence, leans forward and said, did you have a family? Yes. He said, I had a son, but I lost him. Oh, he wants to learn more. You lost your son. Can you tell me about him? Well, he was unusual. Yes, he had holes in his hands and feet. Jesus leans in and he goes, Father? And the old man leans forward and whispers, Pinocchio? This is a taste of what you're going to get. Because laughter is a form of grace. It's the upside. Often when we least expect it, grace is given to us. My friends, the point is that we face the gifts of life. We welcome them even in their adversity. And in so doing, we find our spiritual center. Before my friend's daughter died of cancer, we were by her bedside. She was drifting in and out of consciousness at that time. At one point, she came back, and her eyes opened wide, and she said, Daddy, it's so beautiful out there. As ever, I was convinced, as I have been for most of my professional career, that she had glimpsed another side that we can't see from the veil that is our reality here. Years later, my friend sent me a Christmas card reminding me of what his daughter had said, and he said, grace is a drug, John. We'd been having a conversation about this, but it has helped me to heal. And I still miss her terribly. But now I know she was part of that same grace we call life, and I go on remembering what is truly beautiful. So, my friends, may grace of a billion names bless us on this journey that we are upon, and may we find ways of hope in only the ways that we have yet to imagine, that we belong to life, that we belong to each other, and ultimately, we belong to the very stuff of stars. So may it be. And amen. Our benediction comes from Frederick Gillis. May the love which overcomes all differences, which heals all wounds, which puts to flight all fears, which reconciles all who are separated, be in us and among us. Now and always. Go in peace and go with grace. Amen.